Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
The Crusades loom large in contemporary popular consciousness. However, our public understanding has largely been informed from a Western perspective, despite the fact that there's a rich textual tradition recording its history in Muslim sources. Paul Cobb remedies this problem in The Race for Paradise, An Islamic History of the Crusades, by presenting the fullest and most readable account of the Crusades relying on Islamic sources. Cobb expands on the geographical and chronological boundaries of the Crusades by placing traditional conflicts within Muslim accounts of Frankish aggression. In general, medieval Muslims were not overly concerned with Europeans, and ongoing relationships between Christians and Muslims only really existed in the Mediterranean context. European expansion into Muslim lands throughout the Middle Ages marked a different phase of encounter, but were not always clearly demarcated by religious boundaries. Cobb illustrates the often competing logic behind political alliances, military aggression and intervention, or discursive justification. The Race for Paradise does a wonderful job of presenting the narrative in a new light and dissolving many of the assumptions about pre-modern conflicts that have been produced by one-sided accounts of the Crusades. In our conversation, we discuss the Frankish conquests, the significance of Jerusalem, Mediterranean Muslim communities, Arabic sources, notions of jihad, Frankish rule in the Levant, Saladin and his political heirs, thinking about the Crusades today, and a very interesting conversation about making an audiobook. I'm one of your co-hosts, Christian Peterson, and thanks again for listening to New Books in Islamic Studies. Without further ado, here's my conversation with Paul Cobb. Welcome, Paul. Thanks for joining us here on New Books in Islamic Studies.
Thank you, Christian. I'm very happy to be here to talk about my work and to share some ideas with you.
Yeah, now this book, The Race for Paradise, An Islamic History of the Crusades, it's a unique work. It's very well written, very readable, which is important for these kind of narrative histories. But before we get into the book itself, it's our tradition here to find out a little bit more about the authors. So could you tell us a little bit about your background, perhaps important influences or mentors you've had in your training, and what brought you to Islamic studies?
Sure, I'd be happy to. Well, this will have to dig deep. Let's see.
That's good.
I was an anthropology major originally as an undergraduate at UMass Amherst, which is the town where I grew up. So I grew up in a college town, so the academic lifestyle was known to me and, ironically, was seen as attractive to me, little did I know. And so as an anthropologist, anthropology major, I was also a classics minor. So took some Greek and Latin. But I had the sort of, you know, typical undergraduate hubris that I thought I would somehow combine anthropology with classical studies in some way. And, I realized very quickly that you know, hundreds of people had done this before me. But anyway, it was an intriguing mix. I liked languages, and I really loved anthropology and the idea of studying culture, the capital C, and other cultures. So I found very healthy and intellectually nourishing. But it was, I was not actually originally interested in the Middle East, but it was at UMass in the anthropology program. It was not required, but it was encouraged that students sort of try out some of the various disciplinary wings of anthropology, like linguistics or cultural anthropology or what have you, including archaeology. And I remember sort of thinking that I might be on an archaeological dig. So I looked around at all the various bulletin boards, like actual bulletin boards. You remember those? Yeah. For ads, asking for volunteers for archaeological digs. And the ones that happened to be advertised, this was in the 80s, were either in, I should say, that made use of my interest in the classics. Were Roman or Byzantine sites in the Near East, in either Israel or Jordan. So I thought, well, I should probably take some Arabic. And that was, it was studying Arabic that I think was the primary vector for me catching this bug. And then finally going on an archaeological dig in Jordan in 1987, I think, summer of 87. That was my first trip to the Middle East, first time I visited the region and was able to, you know, not really use the language much after a couple of years of Arabic, but, you know, to try and to make friends and to travel around a bit. And that really opened my eyes, I would say, to the Middle East as a real place, as opposed to this kind of exotic, fantastical place. This was also, you know, the Reagan years, when there was a lot of, particularly given events in Libya at the time, there was a lot of sort of racist stuff being thrown about in American popular discourse about Arabs in the Middle East. And I was sort of energized by this visit in 87 to, with almost kind of, you know, missionary fervor to sort of spread the word that, you know, the Middle East is full of real people with real needs and real and real perspectives on life. I went back on the same dig a subsequent season in 89, and when I applied for graduate schools, I actually thought I might continue to be doing archaeology or anthropology, but specifically in the Middle East, and I didn't. I wound up going to grad school at the University of Chicago and fell under the wing of some historians who sort of took advantage of my love of languages. And rather than working on Byzantium or Rome in the Middle East, I really got interested in Islamic history and Islamic sort of literary production, Islamic studies, and Arabic literature. And I've been there ever since.
Now, Paul, you've written a lot, and it's primarily focused on the medieval period. This project itself, can you talk a little bit about how this began to emerge as a book and kind of where it's situated within your broader research trajectory?
Sure. It's a bit odd, actually, if you consider it in my sort of, if you take all my books together and line them up, people either know me as someone who, if they know my work at all, they know me as someone who's worked on the Crusades, or they know me as someone who's worked on, let's say, the early Islamic period, the rise of Islam, the early caliphates. I sort of, it almost looks, if you were to put it on paper, almost looks like I had some sort of midlife crisis and fled early Islam. I suppose I did. In a way, I had a sort of historiographical, not crisis really, but a historiographical change of heart. I started out at Chicago working with Fred Donner on early Islamic history, and that was a very nourishing and exciting, intellectually exciting time for me, learning about the vagaries of early Islamic historiography and what we can and cannot know from our sources, the complexities of early Islamic law, and the relationship of the Islamic world to its neighbors. And that's sort of what I thought I was going to be working on, actually, was maybe Byzantine-Muslim relations in Syria, in, you know, the Bilad al-Sham, the greater Syrian zone of the Eastern Mediterranean. But in fact, I wound up working on a slightly later period, on the Abbasid period, so comparatively journalistic from what I was originally interested in, you know, the 9th century as opposed to the 7th, where there were much more abundant sources, but above all, this local history by a medieval Syrian historian named Ibn as-Sakir, who wrote this famous biographical dictionary, not really a chronicle, called the Tarikh Medini Dimashq. And that is a vast encyclopedia of data, of information, and of stories about medieval Damascus and medieval Syria from the time of Adam until the time of Ibn as-Sakir, who wrote in the 12th century. And it had always been a favorite book of Donner's, and I know he was one of the first people to really mine it in some of his own work. So when I was looking through it, I was looking for material dating from the Umayyad and Abbasid period. And what I found is there was tons of material, and especially tons of material from lost sources from the Abbasid period. Syria is always associated, of course, in Islamic history with the Umayyads because their capital was for so long in Damascus. And as a result, they turn up a lot in a lot of the local chronicles, like Ibn as-Sakir. So it wasn't surprising to me to find a lot of Umayyad material. But, you know, the old picture of Islamic history is that after the Umayyads moved on, after they were kicked out in the Abbasid Revolution, so-called, of 750, Syria stopped to be an important place. And I found that intriguing because there was so much material that that suggested there was some importance to Syria even after the Umayyads left in works like Ibn as-Sakir. So I decided to give up on the Byzantines altogether and to write about what happened to Syria after the Umayyads left. What would happen if you kept the camera rolling in Syria after 750, and what did it look like? And that became my dissertation, which became my first book, White Banners, which was about the sort of political shenanigans of Syrians who had been used to occupying the center of the Islamic world and were now reduced to being mere provincials. And that was, I would say, my first grappling with the idea of perspective. And I found that to be very eye-opening for me because, you know, as you know, Christian, the way we study Islamic history and the way even that it is still taught in academia today is based largely on one perspective, on one narrative, which is that of At-Tabari. And that's an Iraqi-centered, Sunni-centered idea of a kind of sacred history of how God has intervened in the lives of good Muslims. And in that narrative, Syria has a brief flash of importance in the Umayyads, and then not so much. And I wanted to sort of experiment with ways of breaking up that narrative. And so working in Syria was one of those. And I've sort of been in and out of Syria ever since. That tends to be my geographical focus almost on everything that I do. I got my first job, my first tenure track job anyway, was at Wake Forest University in North Carolina, which was a very congenial place. But there were not a lot of other fellow travelers there. The opportunity came up for me to move to Notre Dame. And I was there for almost a decade, and it was, you know, sort of in the ballpark of Chicago, so it was nice to be in my old stomping grounds. But what I was confronted with at Notre Dame was the Crusades, which I had never really studied before, to be perfectly honest. I think I had read one book, there's a sort of pretty well-known textbook by Meyer that one reads, and I think that was the only thing I had read on the Crusades, except for some encyclopedia articles as a kid. up to that point. But Notre Dame is famously a Catholic institution, and they have a superb medieval institute and medieval studies program. And being at that time, anyway, the Islam guy, you know, the only Islamic historian or Middle East historian, that's no longer the case now, but back then it was. They were keen to have me say something intelligent about the Crusades. But never having really studied the Crusades, I sort of pushed off the invitations and the pressure to come up with, a course on the Crusades. But eventually I came around because, and it was again through literature and through language, I had read Philip Hitti's translation of Osama ibn Munkid's so-called memoirs, known as the Kitab al-Ihtibar, but which I've forgotten the exact title of Hitti's translation, but you know, it's the famous one. It's called like Memoirs of an Arab Syrian Gentleman from the Time of the Crusades or something like that. And had read some, had tried to read some of the Arabic as an undergrad, but couldn't. So I thought, well, this would be, you know, a good opportunity with a great support system of eminent medievalists and a superb research library to maybe have another go at Osama. And it was actually not through the Crusades per se, but through Osama, a Muslim who just happened to be contemporary to the Crusades, and his literary world that I got interested in Crusader history. So I worked up a course on the Crusades, which incorporated not just the usual stuff from Osama, but also from some other Muslim sources. And I began reading Osama in earnest, and was eventually asked, since I was kind of obsessed with him at the time, by Patricia Crona to do a little biography of him for her series on Makers of the Muslim World. Do you know that series?
Yeah.
It's a lovely series. They're, the books are, as always in our field, too expensive, but they're great little short little readable introductions to the life of Muslims who might be prominent or might not be. I love the oddball selection in that series, and I think Osama is an oddball selection too for many reasons, but. He also, I think, has a good story to tell about his age to modern readers. And one of the things I wanted to get across in that book, that biography of Osama, is that for all that we today, moderns, and in particular in the West, associate Osama with his memoirs, because, you know, there are excerpts from his memoirs translated in practically every reader of medieval history, every textbook somehow mentions him. He was actually better known as a poet and as a man of letters, as an adib in his day. So I wanted to kind of redress the balance there. In fact, I had originally planned never to mention the Crusades at all in the book until I get yelled at by Patricia on that. And was just going to focus on his literary career. But I did want to stress his other literary pursuits, his interesting and adventure-filled life story. So it helped that a lot of his literary profile had only come to light after, over the course of the 20th century. So a lot of manuscripts, and a lot of, even books that hadn't been associated with him before. Had come to light, so I think we have a better sense of him as a literateur than we used to. So it was kind of a timely opportunity for me to write such a thing, and it was also my first opportunity to write something that wasn't for like other professors, you know.
Yeah.
And I found that very. I found it freeing and liberating to be free of the footnote, and I very much enjoyed the exercise. It was a brief one because they're brief books, but I enjoyed the challenge of taking the sort of complicated thoughts that I'm used to having and used to just putting on paper, to kind of not reducing them, but distilling them to a readable life story of another human being. And that was educational for me, not just about writing, but also about Osama. You know, I think I learned a lot about him in trying to relate him to my imaginary audience of learned non-specialists, you know. So that was a very positive experience. It was also in the course of that book that I realized that Hitti's translation was awful. And I had to, if you look through that biography, it is Hitti's English translation that I cite. It was the only one around at the time. But it was then that I realized Osama was too interesting a person to be kind of just left with that one translation written in the 1920s. So I set about doing a new one, which I did for Penguin Classics not long after. And that came out just after I left Notre Dame and when I arrived here at Penn. The trick with the translation was, well, in a way, it brought me back to my interest in language and literature, but also combined some of the things that I had learned in graduate school as a historian, too. So it was kind of a nice mix of things. I was an idiot, really, when I thought about translation before actually taking this on. I mean, you know, in the course of your graduate education, you do a little translation, but you know, sitting down to do a long, complicated text by a very crafty literateur like Osama was not for the faint of heart. Also, it's also, you know, it starts in media res, you know, it starts in the middle of things with, you know, there's some missing pages at the beginning, so there's no context. It's a unique manuscript, so there are no other readings that you can make. And the work did not circulate, so even medieval people's opinions about it don't circulate. So it was a challenging text to translate, and I don't think it's a perfect translation, but I am proud of it, I guess. If only because I think I conveyed something of Osama's craftiness as a writer. And it's interesting. I have come to think that translations of Osama sometimes take on the persona of their translator. So Hitti's translation of Osama makes him sound like a genteel Lebanese man from the, you know, late 19th and early 20th century, you know, with some sort of fake medievalisms kind of tacked on to the translation. It's full of these and thous and archaic terminology, sort of cherry picked from random, like from Sir Walter Scott and, you know, random sort of medieval or faux medieval texts to make it sound medieval. But I think in that respect, Hitti made the absolute wrong choice, because if anything, Osama was known to his contemporaries as a shockingly contemporary person, a writer, you know, chatty and even slangy in some cases. You know, he uses this way of writing in Middle Arabic that is not the very fancy formal Arabic, not always anyway, that you might imagine, but also very colloquial in some ways. And so I wanted to sort of convey that in the text, to sort of make it a contemporary and lively text rather than a fossil. Plus, you know, our world had changed, you know, the world of academia had changed so much. Our knowledge of Osama's world had grown so much since Hitti's time that I just felt that, you know, there was more to add in terms of critical apparatus, you know, our knowledge of the details of his life and, you know, how to translate things, but also how to the sort of footnotes that kind of accrue around a text like that. And I threw in some extra bits from some of the other autobiographical statements that Osama had made in some of his other literary works, so that he wasn't just the guy who wrote those memoirs, but also a wide-ranging author in his own right. So that, in a long, that's a long answer to your question, but that's how ultimately that got me into writing a history of the Crusades. from the Islamic perspective, because by the time I had translated this, translated Usama for Penguin, I was sick to death of Usama. And I was almost resentful of him intellectually that he had come to dominate the study of that, the study of the phenomenon of the Crusades from the Muslim point of view, that there had to be more than Usama to this story. And that's what got me gathering more sources and attempting to write a kind of a narrative for a general audience.
Maybe you, since this is basically a narrative history that you go into great detail about, you know, the whole Near East and North Africa and Mediterranean area, it might not be super interesting to narrate that completely. So maybe you could talk a little bit about the writing of the Crusades, the scholarship of the Crusades prior to your work, and a little bit about what motivated you to then kind of fill this gap and perhaps what were kind of the main goals for the way you wrote this book, the audience you were kind of imagining as you wrote it, and what you were up to.
Sure. I think that's, I'm happy to use that. That's a process I go through every, at the beginning of every large project. And I encourage everyone to do the same, which is to think of the gains and losses. Like what is to be gained by writing this book and writing it in this particular way, and what do we lose from it? And in this case, I knew that the Islamic sources had more to tell about the history of the Crusades than you were getting from, let's say, your standard textbooks or even your standard academic histories of the Crusades. There's always been, I think, goodwill on the part of Crusades historians who work primarily from European sources, goodwill in terms of using Arabic sources. But very few Crusader historians had been Arabists, and even when they did know some Arabic, they I don't think were equipped to handle the rather sophisticated historiographical traditions of the Islamic world. And you know, the what I alluded to, the sort of craftiness of authors like Usama, but also many others as well. You know, to get into the worldview of our medieval Arabic authors. And, you know, so you might find some translated Arabic texts or quotations or references to them popping up, but no real engagement. So I started doing this, and I quickly came across the work of other scholars. It became clear that, you know, as usual, I was not the first to think of this, and there had been many brilliant historians before me who had tried to do similar things. I think the most famous book is The Crusades Through Arab Eyes by Amin Maalouf. Of course, it's a very readable book. I read it early on in my career. It's, of course, not a work of history per se, in the sense that he's a journalist, and he's also very uncritical of the sources in the way that I wanted to be. He sort of more or less just quoted a lot of Arabic sources, but did so in a wonderfully readable way. And also, I think, was the first to open this question of perspective. You know, what do these events, which many educated people claim to know about, what do these events look like, though, when you start looking at them from the other side? Around about that time that I began working on Usama, Carol Hillenbrand had produced her massive tome on the Crusades, Islamic Perspectives. And that is a magnificent book, but I tend to see it as almost like a reference work. It's encyclopedic, but there's no real narrative. So I wanted to produce something that was narrative in the way that Hillenbrand's work wasn't, and also sort of had historical chops in the way that Maalouf's work didn't either, and also readable, right? That wasn't just for other professors, but might be readable by people who would be interested in the Crusades or interested in Islamic history, but wanted to see where the two met. So that was the idea anyway, the pitch, if you like. When I came down to actually writing it, what I realized was that there are definite disadvantages. There are aspects of the Crusades that simply don't get mentioned by our Islamic sources. So whole stories, whole famous episodes from European sources whole issues, subtopics simply are irrelevant from the point of view of Islamic history. And at first that was disappointing to me because I wanted to write about such things. But then I realized actually this is really important. That is important to the study of the Crusades, that we realize that not all participants were held to the same hot button issues that we tend to think. The field of Crusade studies is so powerfully shaped by more or less one or two narratives written from a European perspective that we forget that for many of the participants, some of those issues were utterly irrelevant. So it does mean that, you know, there are for people used to the traditional story of the Crusades, there are blank spots in my book. But I did my best to stitch together a flowing narrative. And what I realized is that adopting the Islamic perspective involved adopting two new frameworks, a different chronological framework and a different geographical framework than I think most Crusader historians were used to. Because, you know, the Crusades are, there is no such thing as the Crusades per se in Islamic history, just as actually medieval Christians didn't recognize them immediately as they didn't call them Crusades. What to Muslim sources, these events were just the sort of latest in a broader uptick of aggression from Christian Europe in the 11th century. So this meant that, which began, I would say, in the middle of the, you know, in the 1050s or so. So it meant actually starting the story not with the First Crusade, which was 1099, but rather a generation before, and to explain the place of Europe in the Europe and its peoples in the geographical and cultural imagination of medieval Muslims. And then also the usual story of the Crusades ends in 1291, which is when the Mamluks of Egypt and Syria ousted the last Crusaders. But from the Islamic perspective, the story still goes on in Cyprus and in Eastern Europe, particularly under the Ottomans, who continue to fight Frankish invasions for much of the medieval period. So I had a larger chronological framework and also a larger geographical focus, in the sense that for Muslim authors, it was very clear all of these events were tied to Frankish or, you know, Christian European campaigns against Muslims throughout the Mediterranean. It wasn't just about the Holy Land or Syria, but really on all shores. So Al-Andalus, Spain and Portugal, of course, but also North Africa, Sicily, the Mediterranean islands, Turkey, as well as the Eastern Mediterranean. So the book is, you get a little motion sick, I think. You know, you're sort of zipping around from one end of the Mediterranean to the other, but I wanted to convey this sort of almost global threat that the Franks seemed to pose for a brief time to the Muslims of the Mediterranean. So that was my challenge and sort of my take-home point as I began to grapple with what an Islamic perspective on the Crusades really was.
Paul, one of the other things I think you do really well in the book, and this might be more in relation to kind of a popular conception of what the Crusades were rather than kind of even a historical tradition, but I think, one, there's this assumption that the Crusades were Christians versus Muslims, and you complicate this idea of who the Muslims were and the kind of interconnections and disputes that were going on. And also this idea that kind of a holy war from a Muslim perspective, this idea of jihad was kind of the key motivating factor. And you also kind of demonstrate how this kind of conceptual category was used strategically at different times and places and ignored in other times and places. Can you talk a little bit about that, who the Muslims were in this, or at least in a contemporary imagination of the Crusades, and where jihad as a idea fits in there?
Sure. I actually had in the back of my head while writing this the way in which Holy War was written about by Crusades historians and religious motivations for the Crusades. I think one of the great historiographical or paradigm shifts in the study of the Crusades from a Western European perspective has been that by Jonathan Riley Smith and his students, who have encouraged us all to treat religion seriously, those of us who study the Crusades. I think for a large part of the early 20th century and early and mid 20th century, people were uncomfortable and therefore couldn't believe that Crusaders would engage in acts of violence and what have you for religious purposes. It didn't compute. It seemed unbelievable. So historical materialists, of course, had to find economic reasons for explaining the Crusades, or demographic reasons, or things like that. You know, famously, one theory was, it tended to be the youngest sons of families from Europe, because the eldest sons had inherited lands in Europe, so the youngest sons had to go make it big in the East to make their fortune. In fact, Riley Smith did the actual hard work, and his students, I should give credit, of doing the actual hard work of, you know, counting up the Crusaders and finding out their family histories and actually reading the motives that they themselves gave in documents that they left behind. And it turns out that actually it was economically, financially speaking, ruinous to go on Crusades. Almost no one made big money out of it. Far from it being a story about, let's say, younger sons, whole aristocratic lineages went altogether. So there had to be something besides these material motives or demographic motives for going on Crusade. And Riley Smith said, well, why don't we just take these medieval people at their word? Why don't we believe them when they're able to somehow square being good Christians with killing Muslims, with going on a kind of armed pilgrimage? What if we just try and understand that and get into the head of medieval beliefs about holy war? So that's the general trend over the 20th century, I would say, of how Crusade historians have taken holy war. And what's interesting to me is that the courtesy was never extended to understanding Muslims and their motivations. That I think for a lot of Crusades historians, well, Muslims, they're just religious and they're always going to be motivated by religion. And so it was actually the opposite story that I was interested in. How can we understand the interplay of all of these motives, religious, and I'm using the term religious very clumsily here, I realize, for shorthand, but religious motives with more material motives, with cultural motives, or other social pressures, which encourage them to go fight the Franks. And for me, what was immediately apparent from the sources was that jihad, or the language of jihad, the discourse of holy war in the Muslim sources was modular. It varied from time to time and was used contingently by specific Muslims at specific times, usually to garner support from their superiors or to mobilize the populace. And it was important to me to make that point that, you know, jihad was not the default mode of Muslims when confronted with a Christian threat, but also that there were other ways in which the vast spectrum of medieval Muslims in all their wonderful variety responded to the challenges of a Frankish invasion. Sometimes they went to war. Most of the time they didn't. That is for most Muslims, you know, that there was also a time of theological debate, cultural exchange, cultural conflicts, economic connections. Most Muslims of the Middle East never even saw a Frank. And we forget that because of, I think, the perspective of our sources. So I wanted to show to readers that it wasn't just a story of military conflict, that there were other things happening during the period of the Crusades, which the coming of the Franks sort of either initiated or augmented, trends that were already in place.
Now, Paul, I want to shift gears for a moment, if I could, because I doubt there's many authors that I'll interview that have had this opportunity, but your book was made into an audiobook, and you had a very,
yes.
You had a very central role in making this happen. Just for us future authors and audiobook speakers, could you tell us a little bit about that experience as a academic making this very popular audiobook?
Sure. I'm obsessed with the material conditions of producing knowledge in our world. I find it fascinating, and it's a bit like, you know, when you get invited to the kitchen to see how the sausages are made, you know, sometimes you regret it. You'd rather just enjoy the sausages. But my book is available on audible.com, which is owned, a subsidiary owned by amazon.com. And Amazon had bought the rights to the audiobook rights for my book, and had asked if I had asked about the scheduling of it, and they said, well, it all depends on when we can find a voice actor to do it. And there was sort of a pause, and the producer said, utterly knowingly, I'm sure, said, unless you'd like to do it yourself. That's how I got in. I happened to be on leave. I thought it would be a lark and funny to do. And I'm always open to new experiences. So I agreed to do it. And the studios, the Audible studios, or some of them anyway, are just up in Newark, New Jersey. So not so very far from New Jersey. Not so very far from Philadelphia. So I agreed to do it, and it was an eye-opening experience. I just sort of thought you'd sit in a recording room, sort of like a podcast, and just sort of talk into a microphone. But it was, in fact, a very active experience of, controlling your voice, reading carefully. I think anyone of us who's given a talk at a conference, at Mesa or the AAR, we know when we read out loud, we slur or we say or ah, or we have tics of some kind. And those are absolutely not allowed in an audiobook. So there are these very highly trained people who I now worship, sound engineers, who are able to fix those, but also to coach you on how to, how to survive the process. So I wound up taking 2 weeks, 9 to 4 every day. But we got it done, and it was an eye-opening experience, and I would say generally a positive one. And I would encourage anyone who has the opportunity to do it. And obviously, you find another audience, but also it taught me something about the history of audiobooks, which were originally they come out of the Books on Tape institution, which is originally designed for the visually impaired. And I have a lot of maps in my book. In fact, there's one section of the book where I sort of lean on this old Islamic sieve, parlor trick where we talk about Idrisi's map, which I think a lot of us do when we teach this course, the so-called upside down map of the world. And it's a very, I walk the reader through the map, and it's a very visual technique. And I realized as I was doing the audible part of it, that this is the sort of thing that, is going to be a challenge for visually impaired listeners. And it made me think about the other aspects, visual aspects of books that are not treated with a walkthrough, as it were. And I my sound engineer told me that, in fact, in many books on tape and on many audiobooks, there are now audio descriptions of plates and of maps and so on. So it made me think about how to write for the future, that if to include these sorts of descriptions when advisable, keeping in mind that we have diverse audiences. So that was an educational experience for me.
That's a good segue, too, into asking you about the types of things you're working on now and perhaps some projects we could hopefully see in print and hear in audio in the future.
I don't know about audio, but there's the old truism about grad school, which is that there's nothing like writing a dissertation or, in this case, a book about something to make you sick to death of it, right? Yeah. Some of my best friends in cinema studies hate movies, you know. I'm of two minds about writing about the Crusades anymore, but I think I have something else, a few other points to make, and one is one about the broader context of Eurasia in the late Middle Ages. I sort of moved chronologically across the Middle Ages, it seems like, in my career, so I'm moving a little forward from the classic period of the Crusades. I'm interested in this fellow named Johannes Schultberger, who was a German teenager who was captured by the Turks in 1396 and became the personal attendant of the Ottoman Sultan Bayezid. And Bayezid was in turn captured, defeated in battle by Tamerlane, by Timur. And Schultberger became the personal attendant of Tamerlane and traveled around the Middle East, Central Asia, the Caucasus, Iran, and eventually was handed down to various Timurid rulers and eventually made his way back through Constantinople to up the Danube, back to Germany, where he became a kind of bant or, you know, sort of bureaucrat for the Duke of Bavaria in Munich and wrote memoirs. And so he was away for 30 years in the service of Muslim rulers. And that sounds very exciting. It's a bit like Marco Polo. You know, when you tell the story, it sounds very exciting to someone over a pint or whatever. But when you actually sit down and read it, it's actually kind of dull. And that's the sad truth about Schultberger's memoirs. They are a bit dull. So what I'm using his life and his sort of adventures as a Virgil or a Cicero, a kind of human guide through how Eurasia worked and how interconnected it was at the close of the Middle Ages, in an attempt to sort of resurrect this world in which indeed a Christian teenager could become personal attendant to, that is, a German Christian teenager could become the personal attendant of a Central Asian warlord from Bukhara. To assess what that world was like, what we've lost, and what we've gained in the time after, and that's intended for a general audience, but again, an audience more like my Race for Paradise audience, that is the slightly mythical or Sasquatch like educated non specialist. <you know? laughs> So that's the plan for my next project. And I'm enjoying it very much. I'm motivated mostly by my immense ignorance to move on to new subjects. So this is not to say that having written a book, I've become an expert. But in the process of writing books, I am aware of how little I know about other things. So that tends to attract me to new fields and new time periods. So I'm learning a lot of medieval German and other things that I didn't know I'd have to know about, and enjoying it very much.
Great. Well, Paul, good luck on that. And thank you for writing this wonderful book and making the time to talk about it.
It's a very great pleasure. Thanks very much for having me on the podcast.
That was my conversation with Paul Cobb about his great new book, The Race for Paradise, An Islamic History of the Crusades, published with Oxford University Press in 2014. Thanks again for listening to New Books in Islamic Studies.